I'm George Tinker. I prefer to be called by my nickname, my family name, which is Tink. And the title of this session is loosely towards a Native American theology. And I have a subtitle for today. I'm going to call it Remembering the Past and Dreaming the Future. I am a citizen of the Osage Nation, headquartered in Pawhuska, Oklahoma, surrounded by the state of Oklahoma. At one point, the Osages owned most of what is today the state of Missouri. Our territory was bounded by the Missouri River to the north, the Mississippi to the east, and the Arkansas to the south, and roughly along the Kansas line to the west, or a little into Kansas, so that parts of Arkansas in northeastern Oklahoma were a part of our territory too. I'm a mixed blood, which is to say that I'm Indian on my father's side and a Lutheran pastor on my mother's side. The Osages, in what I call an act of unprecedented generosity, ceded their territory to the United States government shortly after the United States actually bought our property from the French. But we, in an act of unprecedented generosity, in 1807 ceded it to the U.S. government so they could open it up for Lutheran refugee resettlement. Actually, that was only the first of seven treaties we signed. The treaty gave us a piece of land. In fact, it gave us most of Kansas at first. Some of our relatives in Kansas, the Kansas or Kaw Nation, were a little perturbed with that since they thought that was theirs. But the terms of the treaty were that this new territory would be ours. It would be closed to white traffic and white travel, and it would belong to us, and that we would live by that treaty in perpetuum. In perpetuum was the English in the treaty. The Indian language in the treaty was as long as the grass grows and the wind blows and the water flows and the sun rises in the east. Osages figure in the American way that's only 7 years, because we signed seven treaties in 49 years, each time giving up a bigger piece of property for a smaller piece of property, and along with that trade, assurances of more and more government subsidies through the year to keep us, sustain our lives. As our hunting grounds, hunting territory was reduced, we had to rely on government promises, for instance, for food subsidies. First of all, in the winter, then as the land base got smaller, winter and spring, and then the fall, and then finally, we relied on U.S. government for food help all year, all four seasons. That's not untypical of other Indian people's story. And the result is that Osages and other Indian tribes became increasingly dependent on the U.S. government, so that people who had once been completely independent and self-sustaining today are reduced to abject poverty, poverty that we never knew in the past, and are totally dependent on handouts from the U.S. government. They're not really welfare handouts. They're treaty entitlements. But even though they're treaty entitlements, when you go down to the agency to pick up your USDA commodity foodstuffs, you feel pretty much like you're not self-sustaining, pretty much like you have very little reason to maintain any self-esteem. And so you go home and mix up your commodity flour with your commodity baking powder and your commodity lard and fry up what we now call traditional Indian food. It's reservation food. There's nothing traditional about it. We call it fry bread. And then just to make sure that we're taking good care of the diabetes, eating all this fried bread, we can take USDA commodity honey and pour all over the fry bread, and we're in good shape. 50% of Indian adults, we're told, have adult onset diabetes today. The Indian community is roughly 50% unemployed nationwide, roughly 50% alcoholic nationwide, runs a diabetes rate 6 times the U.S. rate, heart disease 7 times the U.S. rate, tuberculosis 7 times the U.S. rate, and a longevity statistic that is still stuck at 20 years less than U.S. averages for men and women, which means that I have very nearly lived my entire Indian life. Am considered already at this point an elder in the Indian community. In fact, I'm coordinator of the Elders Council for the American Indian Movement of Colorado. And I can assure you, I don't feel very old, and I'm not sure how I feel about being called an elder and being treated that way, especially by the young. We've got 20-year-old kids deferring to me as an elder, and I'm not ready to be deferred to yet. So that when we talk about an American Indian theology, we've got to throw all of this stuff into the mix. The truth is that colonization destroys people. It destroys people in Africa. It destroys people in the Philippines. It destroys people in South America. But it destroys people in the United States too. It destroys the colonized wherever they are, and we are what we prefer to call an example of internal colonialism. Unlike other colonial situations where European outposts were established, along the African coast, for instance, here what we experienced was the invasion of European immigrants in waves beginning in about 1600, actually 1580 with Roanoke, Virginia Colony, and 1620 with Plymouth Colony. So that we're colonized in our own country, but have lost our country and have lost our lands and are surrounded by white Americans. And there are those who would like to finish the job now and say to us that we have no right to be Indians anymore. Sandra Day O'Connor said it 3 weeks ago in the majority decision on the affirmative action case in the Supreme Court, that we are one race in this country. One race means there's an awful lot of us sitting out on the margins who have no participation in the goods and riches of the one race of this continent. It's just another way of excluding us from any hope of being self-determining and self-sustaining, self-supporting peoples on this continent. So that if we're going to be talking about American Indian theology, we're going to have to pay some attention to American Indian cultures and the difference between Indian cultures and your American culture or cultures, because Europe is cultures, not one culture, but many. But we're also going to have to pay attention to this thing that Latin Americans began calling in 1970 with Gustavo Gutierrez's book, Liberation Theology. You know, our theology is a liberation theology. It must be. So that even in Denver at Living Waters Church, we're constantly talking about how we can, as a community, bring ourselves together, be a part of a healing process of our community, so that we can begin to stake out our liberation, begin to name our liberation, begin to experience our liberation. The other side of that is, there can't be any real healing of the Indian world without some concomitant healing of the colonizer, because colonialism doesn't just destroy the colonized, it actually erodes away the health and well-being of the colonizer as well. So that the colonizer, who is only able to invade another people and displace them and reduce them to slavery by developing a mythology that says we, the colonizers, are somehow better than, have more right to the land than those people do, has eventually learned to internalize that and live out of it for a number of centuries. And overcoming that is very difficult. Once you have justified the use of violence to conquer another people, violence is a virus that then becomes a part of your culture and begins to infect generation after generation after generation. So that in the United States, we're dealing with, in general, what I call a culture of violence. And in Denver, we've got politicians who decry the violence of gangs, just to give you an example of what I'm getting at. They decry the violence of gangs on the streets of Denver. And Denver's a major gang city, just a notch below New York, Chicago, Detroit, Los Angeles. In the next tier, you have cities like Denver with 7,000 or 8,000 gang members in a city of 2 million. Actually, in a city of 700,000, because the rest is all suburbs. Jim Wallace from Sojourner had what is for me the most precious insight about gang violence. Jim said, you know, a lot of people criticize gangs as having somehow misunderstood or lost sight of the American value system. They just don't understand the American value system. Jim went on to say the exact opposite is the truth. They have understood the American value system and are implementing it as best they can. And there's a radio talk show host that you hear in the morning nationwide. Maybe you all have heard him. His name is Imus. Is that a familiar talk show host? I've only caught him once or twice, so I'm not a big radio fan or TV fan. But he was talking about a book that a columnist put him onto about four Detroit gang members. They'd come up from the Deep South, they were African American, and got into selling drugs in Detroit. And Imus was saying, until I read the book, I could never understand why they would do that. But I read the book, and he said, now I understand. In 4 years, they made $70 million. He said, of course, they're in jail now. But, you know, they were trying to implement the American value system, which is supply and demand, capitalist free market economies. Never mind that drugs are an illegal substance. They were selling what was close at hand, what they could sell in order to make a profit. The culture of violence dictates that they're free to do it violently as long as they think they're doing what they need to do. I mean, we're actually teaching our children today, our smallest children, that any act of violence they perpetrate is okay as long as they think they're in the right. We do it with movies like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, with these Ninja Turtles knocking people around, not killing people because it's a kid's movie, so we're a little more subtle, but they knock people around at will outside of the law now. You know, they're functioning outside of the law. Or you have movies with Arnold Schwarzenegger or Sly Stallone. Interrupt me anytime. Yes.
There's a book called The Myth of Redemptive Violence. And that's what it's about, is
that's
how
right.
We have incorporated
that's
violence
it.
As
that's
redemption.
It. That's it. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, redemptive,
and,
yeah.
But it's a part of who we are as North Americans. We can't beat up on Iraq until we have desensitized our children to violence so that they can participate in violence, see violence, understand violence as a part of their daily fare. Then we can beat up on Iraq, we can beat up on American Indians, we can beat up on the marginalized anywhere in the world, including in our own territory called the United States. Well, liberation has got to free both of us from that cycle of violence. You know, Indian liberation necessarily requires white American liberation. So that if we're going to talk about the past and remember the past and dream the future, we've got to dream a future in which we begin forcefully as a nation to say, as a national community, to say no to violence. There's a novel I like to use by Leslie Silko, written in 1977. It's the great Indian novel. At least I think it is. I mean, there are a lot of Indian fiction writers, and Silko's one of the best storytellers around. The novel's titled Ceremony. Any of you read it? Just one. In the beginning of the novel, she starts by offloading responsibility for the novel onto this mythic Laguna figure, Tzitzinako, Thought Woman, Spider Woman. So that the whole story, the whole novel then becomes not Silko's novel, but Tzitzinako's story. And it's a poem. The very beginning of the novel, the poem ends, I'm thinking a story. And as I think this story, it is beginning to happen. Well, in a sense, where I'm headed towards in this 2-hour session is a conversation with y'all in which we begin to think a new story for the United States and for the world. Begin to think and dream a new story, because it ain't gonna happen, folks, until we begin at least thinking it into being. If we don't begin to have a vision, a common vision about where we're going, it won't happen. If you're gonna wait for Newt Gingrich to have the dream, It's going to be a nightmare. And it's going to happen. That's the scary thing about that nightmare. It's going to come into being. Because Tsitsinako is not the only one who dreams dreams. You know, there's evil in the world that is also thinking a story and creating history for us, creating reality for us, so that we have to be more powerful in thinking our story than they are in thinking theirs. Well, in Indian theology of liberation, I invite you all to engage me in conversation at any time. If there's a comment you want to make, something you didn't understand, a question you want to pursue, bring it up. And eventually, I'm going to stop talking and hope to involve you all in some discussion. But I asked for a 2-hour time block instead of the usual 1-hour block, precisely so that we can get some conversation going about how do we dream this new dream? Well, I think that there are some things that have to be understood about American culture, about your American culture, white culture, as well as understanding some things about Indian culture. It's curious that my students at Iliff School of Theology typically have a great deal of trouble conceiving of themselves participating in a culture. They think of African Americans as having a culture, Indians as having a culture, Asians as having cultures, Latinos as having cultures, but white Americans don't have culture. White Americans have operas and museums. And that's culture. Right? If the shoe fits, yeah. But there is a white American culture. And all sorts of subcultures from Boston to San Diego that people participate in. I'm reminded of being in Germany 20 years ago, and the man I went to study with, his wife was from Oldenburg. Anybody know where Oldenburg is? Do you know where Ostfriesland is in Germany? Ostfriesland is Germany's Texas. If there's anybody here from Texas, I apologize, but there are more Ostfriesland jokes in Germany than there are Texas jokes in the United States, almost. I mean, Ostfriesland is a culture unto itself, a very different sort of place. It's in the northeast of Germany, borders on the Netherlands, and in many ways their language is much closer to Dutch than it is to the Hochdeutsch that we all learned in school. Well, Oldenburg is right outside of Ostfriesland. It's not Ostfriesland. And yet this woman had an aunt who was in Ostfriesland that she'd never met. And so she took the opportunity to go visit her aunt and get to know her. And her aunt was glad to see her, invited her in, immediately offered her tea, and poured tea. Well, my friend drank the tea dutifully. And if you all have been to Germany, you know that German peoples drink to the last drop. I can't tell you how many homes I was in where they would not pour me a second cup of coffee until I'd finished the cold coffee at the bottom of my cup. And my culture is I drink it halfway down and warm it up. Not in Germany, it's too precious. So I remember a hostess leaning over my shoulder looking at the dribbles in the bottom of my cup, waiting for me to finish it so she could pour me some more. So she drank the tea and allowed us how that was enough when her aunt offered her more, that she didn't want any more tea. Her aunt filled her cup anyway. And she's German, so she drank the tea. Her aunt offered her some more, and she said, "No, thank you, Auntie, I better not have any more." And her aunt filled the cup. And after about 4 or 5 incidents of trying to say no to tea, she finally put her hand over the cup and said, "Auntie, I'm going to float away if I have another drop." And her aunt looked at her with a shocked look on her face and said, "But you didn't put your spoon in your cup." In Ostfriesland, the culture is you put your spoon in the cup when you're done, and no matter how often you say no until you do that, you're really saying yes. That's culture. Culture is that set, that enormously large but discrete set of habitual responses to the world.
Unspoken rules.
Yes, habitual, right. That's culture. Unspoken but habitual. Things that we do together. Culture is putting the fork to the right and the knife and the spoon to the left of the plate. I mean, nobody even thinks about it. We may speak that rule. But by and large, we don't, and we go into a restaurant, that's the way we expect to see it. And if it's not that way, you'll find 15-year-old kids picking them up and switching them so that it's right, without any words. That's culture, behavioral responses to the world. And white Americans have as much a culture as anyone else in the world. It may be, in fact, a little less complex than some people's culture. There may be less dramatic rules for whom you can date and whom you can marry and what that dating ritual consists of, but there are still rules and mores that are a part of that. And learning someone else's culture is terribly difficult, but it can be very, very helpful and instructive. That's what we want to do in part yet here this afternoon. There are a lot of folks in the world of New Age who are busy these days inviting themselves in to Indian communities and Indian cultures because they don't like white culture anymore. And they want to say no to white. You can't say no to your culture. You understand that? If we're talking about habitual responses, and we're talking about an enormously large set of habitual responses, I may be able to say no to 10 of those, or even 100 of them, but I can't change who I am. I'm born into a culture. So culture, being a culture, is not like choosing a church. It's a birthright. An environmental right, someplace that you were brought up and taught these behavior responses to the world. So that, yes, sir?
Well, I'm thinking that culture can change. You know, culture can and does change.
Absolutely.
America.
Absolutely.
It's only a few hundred years old.
Absolutely.
And we're a melting pot of cultures.
Absolutely.
And American culture was formed.
Yes.
By the conglomeration of practices.
And that's absolutely right.
From New York to San Francisco.
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely. But people who go from San Francisco to Boston may have to learn a few things about Bostonian culture, but they're more comfortable there than they are, say, in London. They have more to learn in London, and a lot more comfortable than they would be in Berlin, and a whole lot more comfortable than they would be in Nairobi.
So you're saying that when you said that there's some people that are tired of the American culture,
yeah,
and want to see what the Indian culture has to offer and want to join that, well, they have to learn something. You're saying that they have to learn something about that culture before. before they...
No, I'm saying that they can never, without completely divorcing themselves from white America, they can't really leave their culture and adopt it. They can do it, but it would take 40 or 50 years.
Yes.
Yeah, or it would take...
That's how change occurs.
Yes, it would take an enormously long time. And what these New Agers think they're doing is changing their culture in a matter of a couple of weeks or a couple of months, like choosing a new church and going through a confirmation class and learning the doctrine, and suddenly...
But that is how a change does occur, is by people thinking they can do it overnight and somewhat failing, but making a little headway.
Probably cultural change happens more subtly than that, and not intentionally. Probably cultural change happens when a whole community of people begin to do things differently, and we're doing that all the time. Cultures are not static, they're dynamic. They're always in flux and always change. But let me give you a couple of examples. I'll give you one example of, and then I want to get to some hardcore examples of cultural difference. But the first one is just kind of cute. At a particular ceremony on a reservation some years ago, there were a number of New Age adherents who had made their way onto this reservation and invited themselves into this ceremony. And as part of the ceremony, as the drum was being played and the singers were singing, a group of women, a large group of women, 50 or 60 women, each with a handful of long grass, were keeping rhythm to the drum beat. And as you looked through the crowd of women who were doing this, it just happened to be women, it could have been men, so don't get me wrong in this sense. You could pick out the Indian women by looking at the head, at the tip of the grass, the head of the grass stalk that they were holding. Because the whites were holding the grass like a drumstick, shaking it this way. And so the grass was out here like this. Whereas the Indians were holding the grass upright so that as they kept rhythm with the drum, it looked like prairie grass blowing in the wind. And nobody, I'm suggesting, even thought about instructing people on how to do that. They just did it the way it came most natural to them. And that's culture. It's habitual response to the world. Now let me get to a harder example.
Except even thinking of that one. So you tell the white women, no, you're supposed to hold it up that. It's still just a superficial cover-up of their lack of understanding of the culture.
It's only one,
one
habitual response out of thousands, billions.
Yeah.
I mean, there are probably billions of habitual responses to the world. I've never stopped to even try and figure out how many there might be, but yes, yeah.
So you can teach people patterns of behavior to cover up their lack of understanding of the culture, but they still don't understand the culture.
I can learn 100 new behavioral responses, just enough to pass in somebody else's culture. But when you talk to me for more than 2 minutes, you figure out about that fast that, oh, this is a foreigner.
like pronouncing it. We think of raining cats and dogs. Somebody says raining dogs and cats, and you know they're off somewhere.
Well, in fact, I had that experience yesterday when Carmen was talking about being a thorn in the flesh. She was talking about me being a thorn in the flesh or a burr under the saddle of the church. Only instead of a thorn in the flesh or a burr under the saddle, she said, Oh, you're the pebble in the shoe. A perfectly wonderful image, but not one any of us have ever heard before, I suspect. Well, I think there are some pronounced cultural differences that get at not shaking grass, but get at how we actually think and how we see the world. That's the kind of cultural stuff that's going to really cause friction between two cultures. You know, different metaphor for a burr and the saddle, that's not going to cause anybody problems. What I'm going to talk about really causes a lot of problems. First of all, I want to say that your American culture is predominantly spatial. And Indian cultures, oh, I got that just backwards. I want to do that. Temporal. And Indian cultures are predominantly spatial. There we go. My PhD is not in spelling. I have a secretary for that. Unfortunately, she has spell check on her word processor, so we're both in good shape. By this I mean that the fundamental category of knowledge, category of existence for a people is different. That in European cultures and your American culture today, that everything gravitates around temporality. That even spatial categories that are there are subordinate to the temporal ones. And that in the Indian world, it's the other way around, that the spatial categories are predominant.
Can you give an example?
I'm going to give you lots of them.
I can give you one too.
I don't know what the definition is of those words.
Well, it'll become clear. Essentially, time and space. That European culture is rooted in time, and Indian culture is rooted in space, or place. In the Western world, the so-called West, going back into European history to Augustine, there have been philosophical musings, philosophical reflections on the meaning of time. You know, Augustine deals with it in Book 11 of his Confessions, where he talks about time and what it means in terms of long times and short times. What's a long time? What's a short time? Is a short time 2 days? Or is a long time 6 nanoseconds? Depends on the context, right? Yeah, if you're dealing with computer technology, 6 nanoseconds could be a long time. Whereas 2 days at Holden Village may not be not long enough by far. Yet these, you know, that in itself causes Western philosophers to want to deal with time, and even the sense of linearity that develops in the West causes us to wonder about our own mortality in a linear sense of my life finally ending at some point. You have this linear notion of temporality in Hegel's philosophy of history in the early 19th century. Do you remember your college lesson about Hegel? I mean, we all got at least one lecture on Hegel's philosophy of history. The history progresses linear, in a linear fashion, with a thesis that is confronted with its antithesis, And ultimately, this is how history progresses, a new synthesis forms out of the thesis and antithesis. It's good Trinitarian philosophy of history too. Hegel was a, you know, good German Christian. And this new synthesis becomes the thesis, generating a new antithesis and yet another synthesis, and the history progresses in that sort of a linear fashion. History itself is an invention of the Germans, an invention of Western cultures, and one that's little understood by cultures outside of, you know, the Western intellectual tradition. Then you have, in the 20th century, Heidegger writing a philosophical treatise called Being in Time. And philosophers and theologians get a chuckle when I suggest that Hegel could have written a book, Being in Space or Being in Place. It just doesn't compute, because Western philosophers have never struggled with the meaning of place or space, but only with the meaning of time. The sacred in the West is measured in the sense of time. It's become more and more predominant. It's not that the West was always temporal, but we've always functioned in Christianity with a seven-day cycle, right? With worship on the seventh day, so that the sacred is measured at least to that extent temporally. But I want to suggest that it's even more temporal than that today, because it's not just the seventh day, or the first day. Actually, Christians in the West, for the most part, worship on the first day of the cycle, right? The Sabbath being Saturday. But it's not just the day, but it's a sacred time in the sense of being almost precisely, for Lutherans, 59 minutes and 59 seconds. And any pastor who regularly goes over that limit is putting his job at risk. Eugene Crawford always used to sit in his congregation in Omaha, director of National Indian Lutheran Board, in the back row, watching his watch. He sat in the back row so that he could get out at the end of the hour and be the first in line at the International House of Pancakes, where they had Sunday breakfast the whole time that they lived in Omaha. On the other hand, Indian people measure the sacred in terms of space. When you have the ceremony isn't as important as where. So that there are places in the world that are sacred to Indian people. And those places are the place of certain kinds of ceremonies. So that for the Sioux, the sacred places are the Black Hills. The most sacred place for them is the Black Hills, or Bear Butte, or other tribes, Devil's Tower. For the Taos Indians, it was Blue Lake, because Blue Lake was the place of emergence for Yurok and Kayrok peoples on the Northern California coast. Dr. Peak and Chimney Rock were places for doing the rite of vigil, what anthropologists call the vision quest. Sacred places. Naniwaya is a little mound in Alabama that is sacred to, or in Mississippi, I'm sorry, that is sacred to Choctaw peoples, because it's the place where Choctaws emerged out of the earth, when the Creator brought them out of the earth and put them on the surface of the earth in this world. You know, even when it's not a particular place, it's the spatial arrangements that become important. So that when we go into a sweat lodge, or a healing ceremony, a little altar here, a fire pit out here where the rocks are heated. It's important that it be circular in shape, that the entrance be to the east, facing the rising sun. In Osage custom, the openings of all our lodges, ceremony lodges and homes, face the east. unless we're at war, at which point we open up a Western door to our homes, because the Eastern door is there so that we can see when the sun is first ready to come up, because we need to be out of the lodge when the sun first comes over the horizon. With our feet on the ground, ready to face the day. Time of war, you get up before then, so you use the Western door to the house.
In thinking about spatial rather than time, in Indian culture, the celebrations of anniversarial type things, such as birthdays, advance in time year after year that are celebrated at a certain time.
That's modern.
It's modern.
Mm-hmm. That's modern. In fact, marriages, for instance, used to be consummated most commonly at annual ceremonial events like the Sun Dance or the Green Corn Dance, so that that celebration would coincide with an annual tribal event.
They had to do with seasons and not a point in time.
That's right. Has to do with spatial arrangements. You know, the spatial relationship between, for instance, the sun at solstice or at equinox and the community. Spatial arrangements, the relationship between the community and the moon, so that there are new moon ceremonies or full moon ceremonies, new moon ceremonies being more common than full moon ceremonies. Those are spatial arrangements far more than temporal, to the extent that they are temporal.
That those were the way of measuring time.
Yeah, those spatial relationships define time.
But I'm not saying Indians have no sense of time.
Okay.
I'm saying it's secondary to the sense of place. And that even time becomes then cyclical and almost spatial in its configuration.
Well, just like your Americans don't have any, we don't neglect space, it's just not a primary
place. That's right.
I mean, we have sacred spaces, yeah. But it is time that's
But sacred spaces are only sacred for a time.
Right.
Like, for instance, if you have a church,
right.
And that's sacred space, and there's the altar, and you keep kids away from the altar, right, because it's sacred space. But wait a minute. We've really outgrown the facility. We need a new facility, right? Well, I'll tell you what, this would be a perfect lot for a gas station, so we'll sell it to Texaco. And there's an old Safeway that went out of business down the street. And we'll buy that lot, it's bigger, and put up a bigger church there. And now that becomes sacred place. So that we can trade sacred places. There's no sense that, wait a minute, this is a power center. This is a place that has a spiritual presence about it that we need to have present in our ceremonies. So that, you know, we want, in the early days of Christianity, space was far more important. Many early churches, the first two or three centuries, were built on former temple sites, Greco-Roman pagan temple sites. And those temples were built on places that were power centers. And it was very important to realize that this place has a power about it, and that's why we're going to build a temple here. Or why, now that the temple's gone, we're going to build a church here. In fact, not only was space important to that extent, but in the earliest church, the altar was always to the east. Huh? Always to the east. Nowadays, in a Lutheran high church congregation, you may hear the organist, the musician, or the pastor refer to the altar as liturgical east, even though it's north by northwest.
The redeeming reality.
That's it, yeah. So there is that remnant of spatiality that's important even today in the church, but it's a remnant and it's become very much subordinate to time.
And so the same is true for Indians, where space is important and time is subordinate to it. Doesn't
That's
mean
right.
that time doesn't exist,
That's
it
right.
just means it's subordinate.
Exactly, exactly.
Where do you fit on all this?
Where do I
feel like, I'm asking, where do you fit on all this? Do you feel like, just that you're an Indian and that the temporal is very foreign to you, or you kind of mix both?
Well, see, that's the part of the dysfunctionality that Indian people face today. When an Indian person is going to fly to a conference out of Tulsa, it is really important to know what time the plane leaves. because if I miss the plane, I have to walk, and it could be a long ways. So that we're kind of caught in between. What I'm trying to do here is just highlight the difference in order to show some of what happens. One of the things that happens is that things like production schedules, time cards in a factory are absolutely essential to the functioning of the military-industrial complex in the United States and in the entire West. I mean, there is no more capitalism without time. Time is fundamental to the functioning of a capitalist economy. Indian economies, being far more spatially oriented, meant that you just made sure that you had enough to take care of yourself for the now. I mean, it's not that there weren't surpluses. I mean, tribes in California would store up to a 2-year supply of acorns, for instance, to survive drought. Others would, Osages would store corn. So we're not saying that we don't plan for the future, but we don't generate enormous economic surpluses. This system is predicated on generating economic surpluses. It's the economic surplus that makes your mutual funds valuable pieces of property. Because you hope your mutual fund is buying corporations that are better at generating economic surpluses than other people, right? It's called profit. I mean, we track economic surpluses today not in terms of silos filled with grain, but in terms of little electronic pieces of information that are called money.
Money will take care of our retirement.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And it's all an illusion. I mean, it's all even the money you carry in your wallet is just an illusion. It's no longer predicated on even a gold standard. It's merely a paper illusion, and the paper illusion is giving away to an electronic medium that already controls all your money, and it's merely an illusion. I have as much money as my bank says I have. Not anymore. And you have to trust, if you're going to sell me something, that my bank is right about that. My bank's going to talk to your bank, and we're going to trade some goods or services. All that's predicated on temporality. If the sweat lodge and all our lodges open to the east, a major ceremony will open to the east, like the sun dance, or in my tribe, a honka ceremony will be a little different. Well, I just drew a tsisho ceremony with the altar to the north. And those who are controlling the ceremony will sit here. Those who are running the ceremony, facing the south. But the entrance to the ceremony lodge is from the east, and the exit to the west. so that that road follows the path of the sun. It's critical that our village is laid out the same way, with an east-west road that cuts an Osage village in half, with the Sky Division living to the north and the Earth Division, the Hunkas, living to the south. And I said this last week, James Owen Dorsey, one of the leading anthropologists, early anthropologists of the late 19th century, around 1888, had visited many Osage villages in Omaha, Ponca, Oto villages, Kanza villages, related tribes, and seen these villages all laid out the same way, and actually drew a picture of an Osage village for a manuscript he published with the American Bureau of Ethnography called Sioux in Sociology. Only Dorsey has the road cutting the village in half, going north to south. A mind-boggling impossibility. Yet he never knows. He never knows that the road is the path of the sun going east to west. He never knows. And he spoke the language. He published an early dictionary of these terms. And he'd studied these people. Isn't that curious?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not that he was stupid. He was not stupid. He was a very bright man. Well, not even that. He's working out of a different culture. See? And just didn't click with him that this culture is spatial and not temporal, and that the direction of the road is vitally important.
Likewise, if he instead had loose, simplistically speaking, an artist's bent, so he was used to thinking in terms of the spatial terms.
Yes.
He might have seen the spatial connection.
Might have, but he did a nice job of drawing the village. So he may have had some artistic talent.
No, I don't mean artistic talent in terms of accuracy. I mean artistic in terms of symbology.
Oh,
maybe.
Yes.
Maybe that's the sentimental.
Yeah. The other main difference in cultures is the distinction between...
I'm going to shift that to the back then.
Western individualism and the community base of Indian people. It's not always been the case that the Western world has been as individualistic as it is now.
Technology has driven us that way.
Well, either that or the individualism has driven the technology. And so, I'm not sure whether, it's the cart or the horse. They're related. They're very intimately related. I think Western individualism begins, and again, technology's involved. It begins, I'm going to give it a date, 323 BC. I mean, there's a dramatic change in the European mindset beginning with the creation of the Alexandrian Empire. Suddenly, the old temple cults in Asia Minor, all the way down to Egypt and Greece, no longer functioned the way they used to. Suddenly, we no longer went to the temple in order to ensure that our village or town would have a good harvest. See, in the past, we did those things in order to maintain the harmony and the balance of the world in this center, namely in our community. With the conquest of Alexandria, they do that for us in Macedonia. There's no longer a need for us to hold our community together because all that administration is taken care of 1,000 miles away by the bureaucrats. See, and it's technology that enables that kind of empire building. And that kind of empire building that enables technology. So that you have, by the 2nd, 3rd century BCE, a new religious phenomenon sweeping the Mediterranean basin. A different kind of cult. Suddenly, you have what's called the mystery religions of Isis.